things that my family had. But uni changed me. It made me see proper inequality for the first time. People think that Brighton's wealthy, you know, but it's got really poor pockets. And the other students, well, they were also engaged and connected to the real world, you know. It made me ashamed of myself, you know. I charitably assumed the constant you knows were a nervous tick and tried to see beyond them. Good on you, I said and squeezed his arm. Takes guts to really open your eyes. Well, not really if there's a multi-million pound trust fund to fall back on when you get tired of living like the common people, but he seemed to appreciate it, absent-mindedly rubbing the spot I'd just touched. From then on, I was in. It took a couple more weeks of weeding to suggest a drink after work, but he was keen. Unfortunately, so was Lucy, and even worse, Roger. We ended up in a dismal pub near the centre, which I guess could have been nice if a roundabout hadn't encircled it at some point in the recent past. And let's be honest, if the clientele had been completely different and the wine list had offered more than a lukewarm Chardonnay from Australia. The talk was mainly about fucking frogs, with Andrew keen to tell us about his own private collection. Roger rolled his eyes. This chap thinks the local ones aren't interesting enough, don't you, fella? Always looking for something a bit more exotic. He said it as though a foreign frog was dangerous, enticing Andrew away from the decent, hard-working types found in the marshes. Roger definitely voted to leave the EU. I feigned interest and encouraged my cousin to say more, while Roger turned to Lucy and attempted to engage her on the topic of topsoil. Andrew lowered his voice and tilted his head towards me slightly. The centre is a lovely place, and Roger means well. But he's right. I am interested in the more exotic ones, just as he says. It might sound mad. He trailed off as I looked at him with interest. But I've been researching what frogs can do for depression. Have you heard of Cambo? No, Andrew, of course I fucking haven't. Normal people don't think about frogs and depression. Normal people don't spend their days in dingy marshes off a dual carriageway waiting for visitors who never come. But then, normal people don't try and annihilate their entire families, so I really should learn to judge less and listen more. I opened my eyes wide. It's a secretion from a type of frog, and there's a ton of research on how it helps to cure depression and addiction. We're all so dependent on Western medicine pushed on us by Big Pharma, but it's becoming so clear that nature offers us better ways to tackle our human struggles. Cambo, man. He paused. It's worked miracles on so many people. He glanced over at Roger to make sure he wasn't listening and turned back to me. That's why I've got these frogs at home. I'm trying to perfect the dosage. Too much and you vomit uncontrollably. It's a tricky process. And I'm breeding them so that I can increase my supply and help more people. I didn't need to fake interest by now. What a weird path for Andrew to take, doping himself up with frog juice. Surely there must be a nice Harley Street therapist available to deal with his issues in a less bonkers way. Then again, rich kids have always tried to forge their own path, stymied by a lack of drive and comfort levels that make hard work seem unnecessary. Some become club promoters, some weed-smoking artists. Why not a frog dealer? I bombarded him with questions and told him I thought he was brave. I'm not ashamed to say I opened up about my own personal struggle with depression and made myself vulnerable in front of him. Didn't matter that it was all tosh and that despite having very good reason to experience deep sadness, I had been lucky enough to swerve it. Men like women being vulnerable. They like to feel that we might need help, despite any surface-level confidence. By the time we left the pub, I felt like I had cracked him. And yet, my shoulders were tense and my hands were balled up into fists as I walked to the station. He was a nice man, I thought, though fairly clueless. I didn't feel the acid burning in my throat when I thought about him like I did when I conjured him as an image of his father or grandfather. And that feeling, the ever-stoked anger which made my ears feel as though they were on fire, that's what made it easy to kill Jeremy and Kathleen. That's what made it fun. I didn't feel that corrosive sensation in my windpipe for weeks afterwards. How would I enjoy this new challenge if I couldn't summon the acid? By the next shift, we'd swap numbers. One of the perils of a burner phone is never knowing your own number off by heart. And we'd text each other during the week with links to research papers we thought the other would enjoy. I didn't read anything he suggested, but it was easy to react appropriately with a quick skim of the conclusion. God bless these pointless academics who spend years doing some mind-numbing survey that nobody will read, but helpfully tack on a footnote which summarises it all in 2 minutes. Texting might sound like there was flirting going on, but thankfully, I think Andrew really just enjoyed someone who was willing to indulge his niche interest in amphibians and hallucinogens. The alternative would have added a hideous dimension to what I hoped would be a fairly straightforward catch and kill. 4 weeks in and we were firm friends. I knew where he lived, Tottenham, in a house with four other guys all doing PhDs. What his favourite novel was, something by William Boyd, but I forget. And that he was a strict vegan. We started going to the dreary pub after work on Saturday, where we'd get pretty drunk and I'd make jokes about Roger until he'd tell me off. By now, I knew how I'd kill him. Much like with my grandparents, the plan was vague in form and had the potential to fail, but I was confident after my first foray and Andrew was trusting to a fault. After the pub on Saturday, I mooted going back to the centre and bringing a bottle of wine with us. It was a balmy night, and the stars were out, a rarity in this smog-draped city. He was game, if a little nervous. "Roger would go mad," he laughed, "but I guess there's no harm done." Not much of a rule-breaker, my cousin, despite his much-vaunted radical beliefs. I guess that's what 14 years of private education does well. Parents don't cough up close to 250k in the hope that their child willfully breaks the unspoken rules of British society. Security at the Marsh Centre was nothing. There was no security, no CCTV. What would you steal? Some minnows? No barbed wire. Andrew just used his key and we were in. We went down to the main pond and sat on a small section of decking Roger had installed so that he could observe frogs more easily. I cracked open the wine and sipped from the bottle. As we passed it between us, I broached the subject that had been turning over in my head. "Can I try the frog drug, Andrew? You've talked about it so much and it sounds like an adventure I'd kick myself to miss." There was a silence, and then I heard him breathe in and then breathe out in quick succession. "I don't think so, Lara. I'm no expert yet, and I'm still trying to perfect the dosage. Last week I took too much and passed out cold for 15 minutes. It's so imprecise. I don't want to use you as a guinea pig." I nodded and made reassuring noises. "I totally understand. I don't want to put pressure on you in any way. I just thought maybe it might be helpful with my panic attacks in some small way." I trailed off, hoping to capitalise on his English built-in awkwardness. He sighed again. "I didn't know you get panic attacks. I do too, ever since I was a little kid. I used to tell my mother I couldn't breathe, but I couldn't explain it properly. They came back with a vengeance recently." He looked at me with an understanding and rubbed my thumb clumsily. "What happened?" I asked, looking at him with a suitable amount of concern. Men like to be stared at intensely, I found. It shows them you're really absorbed in what they're saying. "My grandparents were in an accident." He looked down and dropped my hand. I didn't push it. Instead, taking the wine again and dipping my fingers into the pond. "Hey, how deep is this water? Roger always acts as though the Loch Ness Monster could be hiding in here." He laughed and pushed his hair away from his face, making the hideous shell earring tinkle. The tension dissipated. "This place is his life. He just likes to imagine that everything here is bigger and bolder than it perhaps is. The ponds are all pretty shallow, though this one I've waded through and been caught out by how deep it is in the middle, probably up to your waist. And you don't want to let Roger catch you. Consider the frogs, Lara," he said in a faux outraged tone. We finished the bottle and I said I'd better call a cab. Andrew helped me up. I was drunker than I'd thought. And we stumbled back to the front gate, giggling and shushing each other. I offered to drop him home, but he said he wanted the air, and I poured myself into a Toyota Prius, driven by a man listening to a strange medley of acoustic show tunes. A few minutes before we pulled up outside my flat, I heard my phone beep in my pocket. Clumsily, I unlocked the screen and peered down. "Okay, let's do it. Next Saturday after work, you bring the wine. I think rosé would go nicely, but it's top secret. Nobody knows that I do this." Despite the terrible interpretation of all that jazz being played as we arrived at our destination, I managed a smile. Gotcha. The following week is hard. I find it difficult to sleep, to work, to do much of anything except think about what is going to happen come Saturday. I remember a moment, aged 17, when Jimmy and I had been invited to a kid at school's birthday party at a nightclub in Finsbury Park. Oh, the glamour. We'd spent weeks organising fake IDs and consulting each other on what we'd be wearing. We'd come up with an eloquent lie to tell Sophie and practice the details so that we wouldn't get caught out in the run-up like so many idiotic teenagers do. This was all on me, by the way. Jim would have been sprung in an instant. Terrible lying face. By the Monday before, We were so hopped up with anticipation that I couldn't sleep. My stomach would flip and adrenaline would seep into my limbs, and I'd toss and turn worrying about whether or not our plan would work. If we'd get into the club and have the night we'd envisaged. It was miserable. We made it, and everything went like clockwork in the end. But the party was a huge letdown, and we got stuck waiting for the bus at 1 a.m. in an icy downpour. Jimmy trying not to be sick, me trying not to go near him in case he was. All that worry and anticipation for not very much. This feeling is similar, except the stakes are much higher and I refuse to take night buses anymore. Prep for Saturday is less about what dress to wear and more about making sure the wine I buy is a screw top bottle and that I have some discreet gloves, both of which I procure by Monday. Then I endure 5 days of jittery feet, racing thoughts, and an image of a smiling Andrew inserting itself into my brain at inopportune moments. Honestly, I don't remember Patrick Bateman ever having fleeting moments of guilt or annoying feeling of moral transgression. It's much harder to carry out this plan with a truly blithe spirit than I thought it would be. Nevertheless, Saturday comes, and instead of taking the train to the centre as I normally do, I walk the entire way, hoping to calm my nerves with the rhythm of my feet. It worked fairly well, actually, and I arrived with a smile, able to start work on painting the accessible toilet door as Roger had directed. Andrew arrives late, and for a stressful 30 minutes, I worry that he isn't going to show. But then, there he is. Hair tied up with a strip of old t-shirt and wearing a pair of patchwork shorts which look suspiciously like they're made of old flannels. His father would have an account at a tailor on Jermyn Street, I think, wincing. What a tragic waste. I wave at him, but don't stop painting. No need to be too eager, especially if he's feeling uneasy about later. As the day wears on, it gets hotter. Roger, Lucy, and the old lady who is escaping her decrepit vegetable of a husband sit in the equally decrepit deck chairs just outside the Welcome Centre and write names of plants on sticks to put in the earth, as if we were at a National Trust property. Thank God for the sun. Rain would surely keep us indoors, and the plan I have in mind would crumble. I don't think I've ever worked as hard as I did today. 2 coats of weatherproof paint and a good scrub down of the internal walls to boot. Nothing like the promise of a murder to boost one's productivity, it turns out. At 5 p.m, Roger brews tea and we all down tools and drink it on the deck. It feels nice, actually, like I'm part of something. Something mundane and totally pointless, but that's not nothing when you've never really experienced it. There have been a few moments like that on my journey, times when I've wondered if God is telling me to get off this road and embrace a different life. But then I remember that I don't believe in God and that if he does exist, then he gave me this life to begin with. What would he know? We head off to the pub at 6 p.m, Roger and Lucy tagging along. Lucy has really come out of herself in the time we've been at the centre. Gone is the slightly nervy rabbit vibe. Today she wears a bandana and dungarees, her face brown from the outdoor work. Is Roger a father figure to her? I can't quite work it out. Given the alternative, I fervently hope so. The pub is fairly quiet, just a few tables of misfits and one young man sipping a pint alone with a book, looking faintly out of place. This is not really the kind of establishment you come to read and ponder. Andrew and I down a bottle of rancid white, while Lucy and Roger sip shandies. Talk is stilted. It's not a natural group at the best of times, especially not now we're counting down the clock like lovers desperate to get home and to bed. Eager to push on, I order another bottle and make a show of saying that I need Dutch courage for a date I have later on. Roger is tickled by this, telling me to make the chap pay and offering advice on conversation starters, one of which, and I kid you not, is to ask which board game was the best. My favourite is, and it's controversial, Monopoly. Nobody asks why it's controversial, and his look of disappointment is a reward in itself. Andrew starts tapping his feet and I begin to worry he'll back out if we linger here for too long, so I decide to be bold. Draining my glass, I stand up and smile brightly. Well, wish me luck. I've got to be an angel at 8:30. Let's hope he's worth it. I sling my bag over my shoulder and clap Andrew on the back with gusto. Roger lifts his glass to me and Lucy waves half-heartedly. I walk out of the pub and turn off the main road and back towards the centre. I decide not to text him, allowing him the chance to take the reins himself. Instead, I sit on the curb drinking from a flask of wine I've brought with me. I don't tend to drink out of a vessel which so obviously screams cry for help, but I have to carry my own wine separately. The stuff I've chosen for Andrew is now heavily fortified with vodka and I need a clear head. Now you see why I need the screw-top bottle. No tampering with trusty corks. 1/3 of the bottle went into my flask and I topped up the rest with the finest spirit I could find. Not that he'll have a hangover tomorrow, but it just feels more respectful not to give him the complete paint strip of variety. Last meal and all that. Although apparently America doesn't give last meals anymore. One guy ordered hundreds of pounds worth of food and then refused to eat any of it. The guards were so furious at this display of independence that nobody gets that final treat now. His fellow prisoners will curse his name, but I admire that man's determination to piss off everyone to the last. After what I estimate to be half a glass, I see a figure lurching down the road towards me. Some men walk with such an air of dishevelment that they look like they've been drawn by a toddler. Andrew is such a man. If there is any doubt, the silhouette of the hair tells me it's him. The slight swaying suggests he finished that second bottle of wine. I stand up and laugh, waving at him with my free hand. "Fuck you for leaving me there," he says, punching me lightly on the shoulder. Roger kept on about council recycling schedules and Lucy does nothing to stop him. She seems to almost find it charming. He drops his rucksack and fumbles for his keys. Once we're in, he dumps his bag on the main desk and I go to the kitchen to find some cups. Can't let him see we will be drinking different things after all. By the time I find them, he's gone outside and started setting up. With a flicker of amusement, I note that he seems to be wearing vinyl gloves. We're both taking precautions tonight then. "I'm going to give you the liquid from a dropper, okay? Didn't think you'd actually want to lick a frog." He laughs, but I can see he's still anxious. "Don't worry about that now. Line it up and then let's have another drink. We can take it later," I say with a smile, handing him a mug with "Frogtastic" embossed on the side. He takes it gratefully and swigs. I tense up, wondering if he'll notice the unusual strength, but he just takes another gulp and sits it down on the deck beside him. As he decants the frog paste, we talk about his field work and the places he wants to go after Australia. Figuring I have nothing to lose, I ask if his parents are supportive of his ambitions. "We don't speak," he says bluntly. "Haven't done for a few years now. It's for the best. My family is toxic." "Ain't that the truth," I think, and rub his arm. "What happened?" "Oh, nothing. Everything. I was just born to the wrong people. I used to joke that I'd been swapped at birth and that my parents' real son was driving down some beach in a Bentley. They're not bad people. Well, Mum's not. She's lovely, actually. But the expectations they had for me all centred around money and my uncle's business, and it was just terrible and vicious. I kept in touch for a while after I'd told them I wouldn't be working for the family, but it got too hard. They'd push it, telling me I was making a stupid decision and that I was behaving like a spoilt child. He swigs more wine. Everyone should drink wine from a mug. Really makes you overdo it. Andrew opens up to me as he relaxes. As I top up his vodka-infused wine, he explains how his father was consumed by jealousy of his older brother, how his mother was emotionally neglected and his sister had died at 9 months old, making him always feel as though he had to live for both of them. I play the silent yet supportive friend, while inwardly thanking the universe that I only have to deal with the one cousin. By now, I've switched to drinking water, but Andrew is so drunk he'd never notice. He's too far into confessional mode, thinking that he can trust me with his deepest and most complex thoughts. Therapists earn every penny. I don't want to rush him, but the family talk isn't detailed enough to help me much, and any pointed questions I ask are being met with slurred and vague replies. Time for the frog slime. Before he is too drunk to function and I have to wait another week. I really can't face another pub evening with Roger. Thankfully, the private school politeness that's been pummeled into him doesn't seem to fade with alcohol. And when I remind Andrew of the original plan, he's all hands on deck. The pre-prepared droppers are brought out, and Andrew explains that he will have to make a small burn on my skin in order to allow the serum to enter the body more easily. "Where do you want to be marked?" he asks. "Most people choose somewhere easily covered." I settle on the foot, since I don't want to have to remember to cover up or explain away a mark on my body. I pull off my trainers and roll up my socks, putting them into my shoes. I scan the deck, making sure none of my things are lying around. I won't have a lot of time to linger after we finish, after he's finished. The rosé bottle is empty and I place it near my bag, stuffing the mug into a side pocket to take back to the kitchen. You have to do it with me, Andrew, I remind him. I'm too much of a wuss to go it alone. Do it at the same time. We'll jump together. He waggles his finger in my face and smiles, pushing a lone dreadlock behind his ear. Don't worry, Lara. I'm used to it. I'll guide you through the journey.
Ugh, journey.
It's not a journey unless you're going from physical place A to physical place B, which I guess he is in a way. He chooses to use a spot on his arm, underneath a tattoo of what looks suspiciously like a dream catcher. I guess be grateful it's not a Chinese symbol? Matches are produced and he lights two, holding them against the sole of my left foot. The sensation is hot but not painful, clearly a sign that I'm in need of a proper pedicure. Then he applies the liquid. Lie down, he instructs. Wait a few minutes and breathe. I gaze up at the night sky, watching him burn his own skin out of the corner of one eye. I hear him exhale and he lies down next to me. If you need to be sick, just tell me and I'll roll you over. Good thing there's a lake. Then he laughs for what seems like an age before falling silent. We stay there in the dark and wait. I don't know how long we're lying there like that. I feel warmth creeping over me, a sense of comfort seeping through my body as though I'm being embraced by my surroundings, held by the wind. I feel it, I whisper and turn towards him. Andrew has his eyes closed and he's moaning softly. I decide I don't want to move. I don't want to stop the connection I feel to everything around me. The constant chatter in my head goes silent and only my heartbeat can be heard. I wonder if Andrew can hear it too. Slow and steady, pulsing through my skin. I feel an animal brush past my fingers and look down. It's his hand linking with mine. Solidarity, a kind of kinship. And it feels nice.
No.
I roll over and use the power of our entwined hands to push him into the water. His body is limp from relaxation and I barely have to apply force, which is handy because I feel woozy as hell. As he moves through the air, his body uncurling, our eyes lock onto each other and he comes out of his reverie for a second. His face twists into surprise and his mouth opens wide as if he's about to cry out. But it isn't enough. The wine and the frog juice have done their work and he falls headfirst into the pond. I sit up on the deck and kick my foot into the water, pushing his head down as I hold on to the edge of the wood to apply pressure. I can see my toenails glint in the moonlight. Though his own feet kick for a brief moment, there's remarkably little splashing before he goes limp and the water becomes calm again. I don't know how long it takes, but it feels like I'm watching it from a distance, so I bend over and stare down at the body in the water, looking for any sign of life. It's probably not advisable to commit murder whilst under the influence of an untested amphibian drug. Sloppy, really. But you work with what you have in this life. When I'm sure he isn't going to burst out of the water, as is law in most horror movies, I lean into the pond and run my hand around his neck. I splash my face and then stand up. Put my shoes back on, pull a towel out of my bag and wipe down the deck, leaving the bottle and one vial of the serum. The rest of the detritus goes into a plastic bag. I grab his phone, which I'd seen him unlock with his code being his birthday, even hippies have iPhones, and delete our most recent messages. I'd been careful not to be specific about our plans over text, but he'd mentioned our meetup and I don't want any questions. I survey the scene as Andrew floats behind me, using the torch device on my phone, and I'm satisfied it all looks good. It looks accidental. It looks tragic, but not suspicious. The perfect balance. I take my mug back to the kitchen, clumsily wash and dry it and put it back in the cupboard. Then I slip out of the centre, pull my hoodie over my head and walk purposefully towards the main road where an Uber is waiting for me. I stop for a second on the road and look round, with an eerie feeling that someone is behind me. But the drugs are making me sense things which might not be there, and I shake the feeling off. The car weaves through the quiet back streets before it hits the main roads full of Saturday night revelers out in full force, the figures spinning and blurring as we go. The whole way back, I breathe deeply out of the window to steady myself and twist the beads on the necklace I'd removed from Andrew's neck as he lay in the water. Another keepsake, I suppose. It was an affectation, really, something taken from movies about serial killers. But they were mainly lonely men doing it for sexual kicks, and I am doing it with an end in mind, and not one that ends in my mugshot flashed across a Channel 5 show about sexy murderers. I get out of the cab a good 10 minutes away from my flat and dump the bag with the towels and gloves in a bin. I pause and hold my breath for a second, feeling like I can't get enough air in my lungs, before deciding that I'd allow myself the rest of the walk back to feel sad. For precisely 9 minutes, I let tears stream down my face and endure the regret which floods my thoughts. As I turn the key in the door, I rub my eyes with my sleeve and shake my head. Enough. A glass of wine and 2 episodes of Golden Girls later, I feel as if the drug has subsided enough for me to be able to sleep. The regret I'd felt on my walk home passes through my system in a considerately hasty fashion, and my last thought before I sleep is not about my sweet cousin, now face down in a muddy pond. As I tuck the bottom of the duvet under my feet and prop a pillow under one thigh at a very specific angle in order to get comfy, my second-to-last thought is that I'd take myself out for a nice brunch the next day. I drop off deciding whether I'd follow that with a pedicure, just to get rid of any frog paste remnants. Self-care is the latest consumerist trend pushed at women wrapped up as empowerment. But that doesn't mean it's not nice. And after all, it's important to look after yourself after a hard week at work. Chapter 6. The worst thing about prison isn't the hours of waiting around in your cell, or the food, or the austerity cuts and privatisation which have led to incompetent fools in cheap uniforms put in charge of serious criminals. It's not the old, freezing buildings where rats are as prevalent as I assume they were in the Marshalsea. I honestly could stick all of these things out with the hope that one day I'll be freed and never forced to sleep below a woman who dots her I's with hearts. The worst thing about prison is that, on occasion, a governor or a politician will decide that we captives need something to enrich our souls, to better ourselves, to stop being quite so rough and terrifying. From that sudden thought, a plan will emerge. This usually involves some lefty sap. You never get a Tory wanting to show us how ceramics can quash our age problems. Volunteering to run a class, which is always compulsory. Where we're encouraged to paint our feelings or some such nonsense. They invariably only come for one class, and then either they're too overwhelmed to come back or they feel like they've done enough to virtue signal about it for the rest of the year. If they're really enterprising, they write a piece for The Guardian about how prisoners just need respect and education, as though they've been working in jails for 4 years rather than for 1 hour in a quiet work period. Today we all filed down to the classroom wing where we suffered through an hour-long class on spoon making. Truly, even one murder wouldn't warrant such a punishment. The only highlight was getting my hands on a proper knife for the first time in a while. It's a pity they count them back in so carefully. Kelly is extremely jealous that I was part of the group forced into such nonsense, and gushes over the wooden spoon I produced. She would have loved today's class, she says, when I bump into her afterwards. And, what a fab Christmas present that spoon would make for your mum. I look at her blankly, wondering how long it'll take her to remember that my mother is dead, but there is no such realisation. So instead, I toss her the spoon and tell her to pretend she made it and to give it to her own mum. She's delighted, and I wonder, not for the first time, what kind of woman Kelly's mother is. To be thrilled with a wonky spoon made in a jail by your grown-up convict daughter, you must have some uniquely low expectations. Her mother can add it to the cross-stitch bird she got at Easter and the dismal sugar bowl made out of something akin to Play-Doh she was gifted on her birthday. The only difference with the spoon is that it has some special marks on it. They look a bit like hieroglyphics, but they're actually the initials of every person I murdered, though nobody would look that closely. Not a particularly sophisticated move, but I was finished whittling long before the other idiots in the class, and I didn't want to waste my time with the blade. I wonder if Kelly's mum will appreciate them. Back in my cell, I take out the paper and pen from inside a pair of rolled-up socks. There is no privacy here, especially with a cellmate like mine. Everyone here tries to get hold of everyone else's possessions, tries to gain their secrets as leverage, wants to know their stories. Kelly doesn't even bother to hide her diary. That woman would tell you everything about her life if you were stupid or bored enough to ask. Once you ask Kelly a question, you'd likely never make the mistake of doing it again. Did I mention why she's in here? Not for violence or theft, like some of us. Kelly was a blackmailer. She had a nice line in getting married men to send her photos, photos which their wives might not like too much. She started small on dating apps and got bolder when she discovered Twitter and targeted men with higher profiles. She's attractive, is Kelly. Big, pouty lips, which I suspect are the results of cheap filler, but look all right from a distance, and lots of red hair. Sadly, her limited intelligence meant she was easy to find when a man finally plucked up the courage to stop sending her money and contacted the police. She'd had the money sent to her boyfriend's account, the stupid cow, and has wound up doing an 18-month stretch as a result. Not an elegant crime, I grant you, but I have no sympathy for her victims either. If you are delusional enough to believe that anyone wants to see a grainy iPhone picture of your flaccid little friend, you deserve to get bled for it. My paper uncurled, I sat down to write for a bit before dinner. I didn't know whether I'd enjoy revisiting my past, but it turns out I'm quite happy to go over it all again. If anything, writing it down makes me feel proud. I remember the urgency of my youthful emotions and the strong need to right a wrong. In the years since, I've not felt much of anything, really. The task in hand demanded too much discipline. To a casual observer, not much happened between the death of my mother and the moment I put my plan into action. A person who ran into me in that decade or so would have come away thinking that I was a fairly mediocre millennial. In some ways, I was. I lived on with Helene for a year or so, which was good, since she was away a lot and I had loads of time to myself. It was a testament to her fundamental unsuitability at being a guardian that she thought it was okay to leave a recently bereaved teenager alone so often, but I never complained. I like being by myself. Other people so often enrage or annoy with their inane small talk and fumbled attempts at meaningful connection. When I was 14, Helene told me that she'd been offered a job in Paris and felt like it was time to go home. She held my hand and insisted that she would stay if I wanted her to, but that Jimmy's parents had offered me a room and were delighted to have me. She looked genuinely distressed, and I felt it would be unseemly to jump at the chance and start packing up my stuff then and there, so I squeezed out a tear and looked at the floor while I told her that she must take the job. I would miss her, I said, but I couldn't live with the guilt if I stopped her from a new opportunity. In truth, Helene was a nice enough lady, and I cherished the link she gave me to my mother, but I was itching to get on with life and start working towards my plan, and Helene, with her limited connections and resources, would not be able to assist me in any meaningful way. Jimmy's parents, for all their discomfort with their own privilege, lived in a world where doors could open if you knew the right people. I felt confident that they could help me in some way. I had nothing to lose, at least, knowing nobody of any importance and having no advantages of my own. A month later, and my bags were packed. The fish and I took a taxi over to Jimmy's house. Helene was in the midst of packing up her life for the move back to France and fairly frantic, so I took the opportunity to grab the box she'd hidden under the bed. I assumed she wouldn't miss it, but I wasn't too concerned if she did. The files were about me and my family, and I doubted she'd want to cause a scene. By the time she realised, she'd be across the channel and immersed in a new life. Jimmy and Sophie welcomed me at the door, their dog Angus nearly knocking RIP out of my hands as he jumped up to lick my face. "We've made you a welcome dinner, Grace, vegetable lasagna, and Annabelle has made dessert." Jimmy rolled his eyes at his mother. "Can she at least see her room before she's made to sit down and eat that mess of a cake?" He grabbed my bags and leapt the stairs, two at a time, as I thanked Sophie and waved at Annabelle, busy in the kitchen with a piping bag. His little sister was a spindly and nervy 11-year-old. I hadn't seen her recently, but Jimmy had informed me that she was already in analysis. Sophie was very keen on juvenile therapy, unsurprisingly. I sincerely hoped she wasn't going to suggest it to me, and made a note to pretend that the school was already providing a counsellor if she did. My bedroom was on the top floor, under the eaves and across from Annabelle. Jimmy was on the floor below. This was the first place I had lived with floors, and the climb from the kitchen to the bedroom already seemed tiresome, which he explained was no accident. Annabelle and he had swapped rooms the week before after Sophie and John had panicked about Jimmy and me sleeping on the same floor. Although nothing was said explicitly, I could imagine them getting in a lather over a bottle of red wine one night, discussing things like consent and hormones and whether their home would be a comfortable environment for a vulnerable girl. They needn't have worried. Though I thought Jimmy was a nice boy and valued his friendship immensely, I'd always thought he looked a bit like a potato from some angles. The root vegetable likeness mostly dissipated later in life, thankfully. And anyway, normal teenage distractions like sex and alcohol didn't appeal to me. I wasn't going to be one of those skunk-smoking layabouts who dithered about university and went backpacking to delay having to deal with adult choices. I wanted to get on with it all. After I'd dumped my bags and caught up with Jimmy, we went down to eat. John had just got home and was pouring a glass of red wine with one hand and absent-mindedly pulling off his tie with the other. He turned to greet me, kissing me on the forehead and rubbing my shoulder before Sophie handed him a stack of plates for the table. The embrace left me feeling slightly odd. Jimmy's family was so affectionate with each other. His mum and dad were always hugging or holding hands, and nobody seemed to find it invasive or annoying. There was always someone around in this house, something cooking, the constant noise of daily life. I didn't mind John's embrace. In fact, it felt nice, warm, gentle. But it niggled, perhaps because I realised that I'd missed out on this stuff. That thought angered me. Normal. I wasn't used to normal, however much Marie had tried to give me some semblance of it. I wondered if this family setup was something I'd learned to love, whether I too would hug and kiss without a thought, whether I'd forget the time I spent with my mother and lean into this new life. The idea had appeal, but I'd have to guard against going soft. The Latimers are lovely people, and I was glad to be living there, but if I embraced their way of life too enthusiastically, I'd risk up reading The Guardian, working in the arts, and buying people organic British wine for Christmas. A lovely, warm bath of a life, apart from the embedded guilt and the glaring hypocrisy that Sophie exhibits so well, but totally pointless. Despite being fearful of letting myself relax too much, I settled into life with the Latimers quickly. Sophie spent a lot of time trying to make me comfortable. Sit anywhere you like, darling girl, please, eat whatever you fancy. The constant emphasis on making me feel like part of the family served to show me that I wasn't, but I understood that this was the only way Sophie knew how to be a good person. I returned to my old school and worked towards my GCSEs, eventually getting straight A's and earning a commendation from the head teacher for my success in the face of particular hardship. The head tilt of sympathy I got from her as she presented me with a sad piece of paper with my name written in badly done calligraphy was only mildly aggravating. I still threw the certificate in the bin on the way home from school. Jimmy and I spent nearly all of our free time together. I got on with the other kids at school, but wasn't concerned with having a clique, spending my life joined at the hip with girls who enjoyed spending hours forensically examining what a boy's greeting meant, really. Jimmy had always had a group of boys he'd hung about with since primary school. They played football in the local park and had game nights on weekends. But when I moved in, these mates were demoted to bit part players. Sophie worried about this, I could tell. She would suggest a game of tennis or offer to host a pizza night for all our friends, which really just meant Jimmy's friends. But he'd just roll his eyes and tell her maybe another time. I couldn't share her anxiety. Jimmy's friends were monosyllabic unless they were taking the piss out of each other, and not one of them would make eye contact with me when spoken to, as though making eye contact with someone of the opposite sex would signify a serious commitment of some sort and they'd be forced to hand over their Xbox in the inevitable breakup. Besides, Jimmy and I got on. We didn't really need anyone else. We enjoyed talking for hours, lounging around in silence, and even doing our homework together. Jimmy never pushed me on my grief, but I knew he understood it when he looked at me. No head tilts necessary. I got into a routine at the Latimers. Sophie and John managed to treat me almost like a daughter, only sometimes wheeling me out in front of friends triumphantly, as though I was a refugee they'd heroically taken in. Although I suppose in a way I was. This was the bargain, it emerged. I was cheerful, helpful, and made Jimmy happy, and the Latimers fed me, clothed me, showed me kindness, and we both agreed to ignore any awkward questions we might have had about how long my membership of the family was good for. Despite my protests, they insisted on paying for me to see a therapist friend of theirs called Elsa, a dumpy woman who wore very large black-rimmed glasses and wooden beaded necklaces, and who barely spoke at all. I repeatedly told her I was excited about the future, and she signed me off after 6 weeks. Within a year or two, I fully understood the wealth that the Latimers had. It was not the flashy loot of my father. It was unspoken but obvious in every way. Food came in huge deliveries from upmarket delis. Flowers were found on every table in the house, big bunches of artfully arranged stems you'd never see in the local supermarket. Sophie could spend hundreds of pounds on scatter cushions from the Iranian interiors shop in Crouch End and call them a bargain with absolutely no sarcasm. They talked about how important it was to live in real London, but they were insulated from anything remotely real. I didn't even know what they meant by real. I don't think they knew. The Artemis Mansion was protected by enormous gates. The Latimers would have thought this awful, but they were no different, really. I recognised how absurd their life was, but it was hard not to enjoy it. Age 15, I found myself using Sophie's expensive face creams and seriously considering 3 different shades of green Faro and Ball paints for my walls. I had never known I might have expensive tastes before. I'd never had the chance to know. But I was fast finding out. The summer before sixth form started, Jimmy and I were allowed to go on holiday alone for the first time. We went to Greece with his friend Alex and his girlfriend Lucy, who went to private school in West London, and delighted and exclaiming in shock whenever I admitted to not having experienced something. It was a crime that I had never been to Greece before. How could I not have had a macchiato in my whole life? Oh, honestly, it was too funny that I'd never been swimming in the sea. It was a huge relief when she came down with food poisoning on day 2 of the trip and didn't trouble us again until day 6, just before we were due to return home. Well, I say food poisoning, but it was decidedly less random than that, really. A few doses of Ipecac syrup given with breakfast, which I insisted on making for this very reason, did the trick. I don't think anyone would blame me. There's only so much time you can spend with someone who goes shooting on weekends and calls her mother mummy with a straight face. Alex seemed to perk up in her absence too, and the holiday was brilliant. Lucy was subdued on the flight home and only gave a tiny shudder when I passed my hand over her leg to pick up my bag. Nobody else noticed. They broke up a few weeks later, which just felt best for everyone under the circumstances. Back in London, I had chosen my A-levels, settling on English, French and business studies. Jimmy spent a lot of time going over university prospectuses with his parents and discussing the merits of different Oxbridge colleges over dinner as Annabelle and I made a great performance of rolling our eyes and sighing loudly. I wasn't going to uni. Much to the dismay of John and Sophie, who seemed not to understand that there was any other option. In their eyes, finishing education at 18 would fast-track you towards a job packing boxes in warehouses, pregnant, on drugs, or possibly worse. It might mean you had to move out of London and live miles away from an artisanal cheese shop. But I wasn't wasting 3 more years on rigid learning, getting into debt and wasting time with other students who I assumed would spend their free time talking earnestly about safe spaces and organising ineffective marches on rainy days. I had things to do. Chapter 7. Unsurprisingly, most prison activities are compulsory. Some of it is set up as though you might have a choice. There's a quiz night tonight in the TV room. We'll need you ladies to pair up. But when you politely opt out, a guard will drop the forced smile and say, 6 p.m, Grace, I expect to see you there with a partner. And then Kelly will grab my hand and announce loudly that we'll be playing together, and I will unsuccessfully try to disassociate from my body. Today there is a non-optional lecture about how to be a boss. All morning, Kelly has been singing Who Run the World? Girls, at the top of her lungs, as though the seminar will be the first step towards managing a FTSE 500 company and not an exercise in platitudes designed to tick a box on a government target form somewhere. Empower these women, some young wonk in a short-sleeved shirt has said. We need to encourage them to channel their specific skills into more mainstream work opportunities. As if Kelly and all the other women on my wing will be shown how to make their blackmail, theft, fraud and other assorted crimes work in a more respectable way. To be fair to some of these girls, in another life they would have made great bankers. But even for bankers, a line in Murder might be frowned upon. I have a few hours before the ghastly talk, so I shall get back to writing. When I left school and refused to go to university, so upsetting John and Sophie, I got work in the Sassy Girl shop in Camden. An obvious plotline for our heroine, I hear you say, but I was 18, had to start somewhere, and I naively imagined that working for one of Simon's businesses would give me an advantage. I started in the stockroom, unboxing deliveries and affixing price tags, and graduated to the tills shortly after. The days were long and frantic. Stock flew off the shelves. The brand knew exactly how to appeal to teenagers back then, selling whatever had been on the hottest celebrity mere days ago. This process was a mystery to me. I remember imagining that the in-house designers must have had their fingers so on the pulse that their clothes matched up with the latest couture completely. I later understood the reality. Artemis Holdings had grim-faced women in head office, subtly altering said couture designs and running the amendments past the legal department. Once greenlit, the garments would be made up in any kind of synthetic fabric they had at the ready. The teenagers didn't give a shit. Glittery jean shorts as seen on their favourite singer for £15. Who cares that they smell faintly of rubber? I surprised myself by enjoying my time on the shop floor. I didn't have a minute to stop and think. I just worked really hard and did whatever was asked of me. Folding up stained and crumpled polyester after it had been discarded in the changing rooms put me off cheap clothes for life. But my diligence got the attention of my boss, a slightly scrawny woman who I thought was ancient but was probably under 30. She put me forward for the Artemis Trainee Manager Scheme, a grand title which just meant I could be entrusted with handling the day's profits. Age 19, I was a titled employee with a badge and a lanyard and the power to discipline new backroom staff. Jimmy was off to uni, along with most of our year group. There were a few who made it to Oxbridge, but mainly they flocked to Sussex, where it was said that drugs and parties were most plentiful, and Manchester, which gave cosseted North London kids some delusional idea that they were really roughing it. Sophie, bless her, managed to spin Jimmy's rejection from Oxford as a sort of moral triumph. Well, Oxbridge is just too stuffy, really. Sussex is such a vibrant campus and so progressive. The kids really learn so much more about the world than we did at St Hilda's. Lucky Jim. I stayed on at the Latimer's house for 8 months, which was a thoroughly awkward experience for everyone except Annabelle, who I suspect liked having someone in the house who wasn't a Latimer. With Jimmy gone and Sophie realising that she was one child closer to an empty nest, her need to try and nurture grew more intolerable. Every day she would make Annabelle a flaxseed smoothie for breakfast. Dear girl, there's nothing for her. She still doesn't need a bra. And she became fixated on trying to get her daughter to meditate with her at every opportunity. For a therapist, she was remarkably obtuse about the root of her neurotic daughter's problems. But perhaps the children of other therapists would say that was pretty standard. It was clear to all of us that the uneasy bargain we'd made when the family took me in was on its last legs. I'd come to their house too late in life to really be one of them, and Jimmy had been the glue which held us all together. Without him, our interactions dwindled rapidly, and I took to spending more time out of the house or in my room. Earning my own money for the first time meant I felt less inclined to follow Sophie's unspoken rules to the letter. I eschewed home-cooked food for McDonald's and chopped all my hair off into a severe bob, which even I will concede was a mistake. I don't have the jaw for it. If I didn't eat dinner with the family at night, Sophie would tell me that she was worried about me. She was never cross, an emotion that she would have found too base. She just expressed concern endlessly. About my hair, about my ambition, about my lack of friends. She was right about the lack of friends. Jimmy was the glue there too. I had never found it easy to forge relationships. Partly it seemed like a skill I didn't possess, but mainly because I had decided early on that teenagers were terrible. I wanted to skip ahead to adulthood where I could be on my own as much as I required. I like to be on my own, and I have never understood what weakness exists in people who crave the company of others all the time. Perhaps that was partly why Sophie and I never connected, really. John was like me. He could hide away in his study or work late hours every night of the week, but she wanted everyone around her. That would show that she was a successful person with a family who saw her as the vital linchpin. So I moved out. They protested, which was understood by both sides to be the standard polite thing to do, and then John paid for me to hire a van and to buy a mattress. They also subsidised some of my rent, which I found uncomfortable at the beginning, but grew to accept. After all, people like John and Sophie need to offset their guilt. Sponsoring a child you'll never meet in another country is base level. Fostering a semi-orphan is big league. I played my part, so why not let them help long term? I found a one-bedroom flat in Hornsey, barely a 15-minute walk from the attic room I'd shared with Marie, and I endured one final meal with the Latimers. Jimmy came back from uni for it. Sophie was insistent. And after a dulcetry moussaka, the woman could never cook something if she didn't find its provenance exotic in some way. He came back to my new flat with me and produced a bottle of wine smuggled out of the family home. We slept together that night, which was a strange but inevitable event. Sex was a form of intimacy we'd been growing more and more curious about as we got older, as we got closer. It was a way of binding us together even further, something nobody else could claim. Perhaps there was a control element for me too, opening up another part of me to him and only him in the knowledge that he would prize our relationship even more fiercely. It wasn't just a calculated act on my part. I've spent years now wavering between loving Jim like a brother and wanting him like a partner. Sometimes he's just a comfort blanket I take for granted. but he's also the only person I know who could break my heart. I still find it all confusing, really, always pushing him away and pulling him towards me. It's not surprising that I didn't let him stay over that night. I didn't want to find him there when I woke up in my new home. I wanted it to be mine and mine alone. But I still opened my eyes that morning expecting to see him lying next to me. I worked and I ran, and sometimes I would meet up with a schoolmate who'd come back home from uni for a few days. I cooked a lot, something I'd never really done before. I studied books about making your way in retail, some of the most boring words a person can ever have the misfortune of having to read. But they were helpful, if only because the bullshit jargon it used gave me a language that was helpful to me to this day. If you introduce a few choice phrases, you're understood to be competent. The PC will love this deal. Tells a retail manager you understand what the price-conscious consumer is and also makes you want to walk into a door. I walked up to the Artemis house most weeks, for no other reason than to remind myself of my ultimate aim. That aim felt like it was getting closer when I was asked by head office to apply for a job on the marketing team. I'd been working at Sassy Girl for nearly a year, and I had no real business working in head office, but I had pestered my manager nearly constantly to let me know if anything came up away from the shop, and she must have taken pity on me. She recommended me for my hard work and interest in learning about the brand, and commended me on my window displays, which must have swung it. Who knew that pairing a pleather parka with a Dayglow bum bag would count as experience? It was a bottom-of-the-ladder job, but it was a rung on the fucking ladder. And it would mean working in the same building as Simon. 5 floors and a world of marble away, but still, a connection that meant something to me back then. I lasted precisely 13 months. The work was simultaneously stultifying and embarrassing. I had no interest in getting the creative juices whizzing at roundtable meetings where we discussed shopfront displays, and hearing about merch to make the client wet themselves made me feel like I was living in a bad simulation. I got 3 good things out of the experience. The first one was that I earned great money for a 20-year-old, and I saved it obsessively. The second was that I got to visit Simon's house when he threw his annual party for head office staff. I would have given all I had to get a glimpse into that mansion on the hill, and here he was, welcoming me in. A proverbial viper, slithering into the bosom of the family. We got the invites at random. It was said that they invited people by drawing names out of a hat each year so that the system wouldn't favour anybody over anyone else. So it must have been a coincidence that the party was full of senior management and pretty young girls working at a much more junior level. Gary, the obese website designer who sat 3 desks down from me, had never been one of the lucky ones. Then again, his appearance and his vague given-up-on-life aura wasn't one I'd want at a party either. The man ate instant soup with the same plastic spoon every day for a year. There were many other spoons available in the communal kitchen. Baffling. The Artemis staff party was a fairly tepid 2-hour garden event with canapes and warm sparkling wine passed around by bored-looking students. There was a candy floss machine set up next to a mini maze, and a few people had made the mistake of accepting the floral hair crowns being woven by an earthy-looking woman who was completely out of place in this palace to greed. Turns out a slightly sweaty man in a grey suit jauntily wearing a flower crown is exactly what a loss of dignity looks like. Even with the dismal activities on offer, you could see that the event was a tick-box exercise. Keep staff morale up by pretending to value them enough to allow them into your home. We weren't valued enough to be allowed access to indoor toilets, though, and a stern-looking housekeeper stood on the staircase should anyone think of going upstairs for a nosy. But for me, it was completely fascinating. This house that my mother took me to, that I stood outside of, knowing in my bones that I wasn't ever going to be invited into, I was here. I was ushered in with a glass and a lukewarm smile. I spent a good 20 minutes just watching a maid discreetly follow people around and then sanitising anything they happened to touch. It was riveting. Bryony clearly had more sense than to mingle with the employees and was nowhere to be seen. Simon stayed in one corner with the male members of the senior management, cigar smoke forming an orb around their heads. He did not interact with his wife once, as far as I could tell. Occasionally, a young female member of staff would be beckoned over and a roar of laughter could be heard across the lawn. One could only hazard a guess as to how many HR offences were being committed in the spirit of banter by a bunch of men in tan loafers and open-neck shirts. I wandered around, drink in one hand, as though I was vaguely looking for someone, and headed through the French doors of the sitting room. Janine wafted around the doors seconds later, her hair blow-dried into a helmet, her gold jewellery clinking like body armour. I assume she was on high alert, the idea of anyone pilfering her lot-bought high-end knick-knacks too much for her nerves to bear. I turned my head away and pretended to be looking at a gaudy painting of flamenco dancers as she strode past me into the kitchen, followed by an anxious-looking woman in an apron and white gloves. Obviously, she didn't see me. People like Janine don't have normal vision. They are blind to people they deem irrelevant. I don't begrudge it. It's a talent I admire. Why waste time on people who offer no value? The corridor was empty, so I continued walking, reaching a wide spiral staircase which would take you upstairs and to their more private space. I hovered, wondering what would happen if I was caught rummaging through the marital bedroom. Would I be thrown out and fired? Would they do a background check on me? Probably not worth the risk, as much as I was tempted. Instead, I spontaneously tried the door to the right of the stairs and stepped into what was clearly a study. Bookshelves lined the walls, stuffed with leather-bound volumes bought for show. I doubted anyone in this family had read the completed works of Dickens, let alone a volume by Derrida. Oh God, alphabetized. On the mahogany desk sat a fountain pen, a stack of thick cream paper, and a large silver heart ornament I recognised as classic Tiffany. There were two gilt frames, both showing the Artemis trio, one which showed Bryony at her christening, the other was more recent, and peering more closely showed the family at a Buckingham Palace garden party. Janine's enormous hat couldn't completely obscure the building behind them. They must have milked this moment to the max, as though it was a private meet-up of mates and not a 1,000-person gathering for people the royal family would find appalling were they able to speak frankly and shrug off their duties. I picked up the photograph and dropped it on the floor. Thick cream carpet cushioned the fall, of course. So I trod on it with my heel until I heard a quiet crack, and then put it back on the desk. The broken glass had come loose, and I used a shard to lightly scratch across Simon's face. Then I cautiously crept back into the hallway. I didn't want to rush back outside, so I lingered in the main living room, nursing my glass. Janine came back out of the kitchen, and I felt ready to make eye contact. Her face had such a sour expression. Permanent, rich lady dissatisfaction etched into her skin. But she clearly felt obliged to come over, or perhaps she just wanted to make sure I wasn't trying to steal the silver. As she approached me, I had a moment of panic. Sophie often commented on how my face never betrays any emotion. She seems almost offended that I don't want to give away all my deepest thoughts with a look. But in that split second, I imagined that Janine could see my intentions plastered all over my face. I started talking about her home, using adjectives to describe her style, in a way which didn't actually convey that I liked it. We had a brief chat about her mantelpiece, the only thing I could think of to focus on. Her posture relaxed a little as I asked questions about the wide array of different marbles in use in the living room, but her smile remained tight. That might have been because of the extensive work she'd had done, freezing her face to a point which made spontaneous expression difficult, but it was hard to say. She talked about how hard it was to style a house of this size and told me that most of her most beloved ornaments were kept at her home in Monaco, as though I would understand the trials of losing track of where my best gilt candlesticks were. "Have you always lived here?" I asked as I trailed my hand across the mantelpiece, deliberately leaving a vaguely smudged handprint. Her hand twitched in reaction, and I could tell that it was taking every shred of willpower and breeding not to smack my arm away. "Yes, we moved in shortly before Bryony was born, since we knew we'd need a bigger place for children." It was strange to hear her talking about children plural, since I assumed she didn't mean for his illegitimate offspring, of which there could be many. It suggested they expected to have more kids. I weighed up about asking that against the prospect of getting escorted out of the house by one of the many burly security guards dotted around, and decided to hold my tongue. "Well, it was so nice to meet you. I'm sure Simon's kids are lucky to have a father so able to provide for them," I said as I walked past her and back into the garden. I heard her calling for the housekeeper before I even got to the French doors. I left that party feeling like I was finally getting somewhere. I had been in their midst. It wasn't just a distant dream anymore. Until now, my interactions with Simon had been precisely zero, unless you counted my pathetic trips past his gates once in a while and the one time I saw him in the lobby of the office. And even I, keen as I was to press on, couldn't really call them encounters. The third benefit of working at Artemis Holdings was meeting my beloved informant, Tina. Beloved isn't exactly the right word. since I'd never have given her a second of my time if she'd had nothing to offer me but friendship, but I prized her for information, and that was more valuable to me than any mate. Tina was the PA to the deputy CEO, Graham Linton, a close friend and henchman to Simon, a man who wore grey suits with a slight sheen, like the type you see in those shops which always say they're having a closing down sale. I got chatting to her accidentally on a fag break one day, several months into my job at head office. The office manager was very strict about people smoking anywhere near the front door of the office. There was a smoking terrace for the top brass on the fourth floor. Cigar smoke would waft through the offices for hours when Graham, Simon, or his brother Lee decided to indulge, but everyone else had to go round the back to the goods entrance. One day, Tina mentioned that she liked my scarf, and I gave her a half-hearted smile, which was more than enough for her to come over and sit next to me. She was the friendliest woman I'd ever met, and that alone was sufficient reason for me to quit smoking and avoid the area. I would have done too, had she not mentioned who she worked for as I was hastily stubbing out my cigarette. It's horrible having to do a U-turn when you realise that you can get something out of someone, isn't it? Suddenly having to flatter and praise a potential donor who's been leering at you all night, or laughing at the jokes of a guy who will pay for every round of drinks, you feel slightly dirty. But really, everything in life is a trade. And I thought Tina might tell me things about the family I wouldn't be able to find out by myself, so I sucked it up and played nice. Super nice. Getting her coffee, messaging her little cheery hellos on our office chat system, having lunch with her and pretending that she was losing weight when she asked. It was a good trade, though. Tina was a loyal employee when it came to Graham, who was often called a creep by women in the office, and not just because he wore an extremely unconvincing toupee. But she'd sing like a canary when it came to the Artemis family. Nothing she ever told me was itself the silver bullet in my arsenal, but knowing more about these people who I'd watched from afar for so long was endlessly fascinating. And because almost nothing she told me ever painted them in any light other than fucking terrible, it was a reminder that I hadn't built them up in my head as monsters with nothing to back it up. Yes, Tina was a gift, even if I had to fuck up my lungs even more to spend time with her. But working at Artemis Holdings wasn't actually getting me any closer to my father, despite my naive expectations. I had somehow envisaged working my way up to be his closest aide within a few years, gaining his trust, worming my way into his life before doing a dramatic reveal and killing him as he gasped at the betrayal. But the man employed thousands of people, and he was no more going to invite me into his inner sanctum than he was going to read a book which wasn't about crushing it in business. So when I was headhunted by another fashion PR and marketing company, I left. My resolve was as strong as ever, but I would be earning nearly double my old salary, and more importantly, I had come to realise that murdering an entire family while working for their firm might not be the smartest of moves. I allow the initial misstep because I was young. This is when the fog that I had always felt swirled around me started to lift and my life became clearer. I got to a place where I felt safe and in control, and I was able to look to the future with more focus. In some ways, it meant slowing down and becoming familiar with the art of patience. I've worked at the same company ever since. I've stayed in the same flat, which I still rent from the ancient Turkish man who lives above me and has not raised the rent since I first moved in, much to the chagrin of his son. I have saved money, kept a low profile and lived life on a small scale, all the while waiting for the moment when I would kickstart my plan and begin a new chapter. It's not a time about which great tales will be written, but so many people live like that every day and don't seek a next chapter at all. They are content with their small and banal lives, their basic requirements met, and ooh, a nice bottle of Prosecco as a treat once in a while. So I don't find it especially odd or disappointing that I spent those years living dull. The best years of your life are said to be those which whiz by in your early 20s when you can drink and party and live spontaneously. Mine were not like that. Instead, those years were followed by a thrilling hurtle through time as I carried out my plan, and now I anticipate many years to come which will be as large and exciting as I wish them to be. I don't mean to imply that I lived like a Puritan. There were little luxuries now and then. I do seem to appreciate the slightly nicer things in life, a predilection which I imagine I inherited from both my mother and father in some ways, and unleashed by living at the Latimers with their penchant for organic wines and exorbitant interiors. It's why my small flat has one wall dedicated to shoes, the most basic starter drug when women look to treat themselves. As I got a little older, I took wonderful solo holidays to places I could barely have imagined when I was growing up with Marie. And every time I sat and drank a glass of wine on a terrace somewhere, I squashed the thought that perhaps my life had turned out better than it might have.